I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam. So, who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Pelizzolo back here with Sam Monson, and we've got a great show of all sorts of fun stuff here today.
Wow.
Great show.
Okay.
Fun stuff.
Cool.
I love when people ask about big-time throws, and we get to explain big-time throws. That's the highlight of today. You actually, you know, you put that in the title.
Yeah.
That's going to attract a lot of people.
See how we have to explain it because you named it so badly?
What do you mean? It's pretty self-explanatory.
I'm just saying,
it's a big-time throw.
If it was wow throws, we wouldn't have to explain anything.
We'll talk about the Packers. Can they sustain their run? We'll discuss a little Monday Night Football, the football team's victory over the Seattle Seahawks. We'll preview Thursday Night Football, Saints-Cowboys, and, of course, run through some new charity ideas because you guys have been so good at helping us out and donating to the various charities and the various events that we've had. So we're on to the next one.
Yeah, we're up over $12,000 in total raise. Throughout the, what have we done now? Four of these things, charity
four
drives.
Events, yeah.
So we're 12,100 and something.
It's about 3,000 per.
It is, yeah. Roughly. Yeah. I haven't run the numbers, but that's insane. Like 12 grand you guys have raised. When we first started this, my head goal was if we could raise 10 grand in a calendar year, that would be pretty cool. That would be an awesome thing to be able to do from the podcast. We did the first one in like the end of June, started July. So we've half that time and we're 12 grand, not 10. So you guys have been amazing. Like this would not have been possible, obviously, without any of you donating. And, you know, we get to do vaguely stupid things and generate money that we give to charities.
And some of the ideas are getting a little more extreme as we go here.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. So a lot of people seem to be very keen on us running some kind of combine between the two of us, including some poor guy who wanted us to, like, me and you on the bench, like bench pressing is not a fair contest. You outweigh me by like 1 million pounds. You have a significant strength advantage.
I have the advantage bench pressing?
Yes.
I've got like 36-inch arms. Are you kidding me?
I have long arms as well, and I'm a lot smaller than you.
No, I don't have any advantage there, bench pressing.
I think you'll find you do.
I also, you know, as a pitcher, which I used to be.
You don't press because that will ruin the mechanics?
We didn't bench press. I worked out with all those NFL combine guys. During bench press time, I was doing like push-ups. You know, it was simple body weight stuff.
Can you do a push-up?
At the moment?
Yeah, right now.
I could probably do one. Probably knock one out. This is for charity, maybe, you know, for charity.
I'm just saying there's some space down there right now.
Yeah, it's off camera at least, so it's not that embarrassing. I could do a push-up. I think more than one, it'd be challenging right now.
Okay.
I'm not built. That's the thing. I'm not built for, even in my heyday, could I do push-ups? Sure. But like, it's not my thing. Like with the long arms.
Yeah. Look, easy. I have long arms as well. And
it's your fault.
Significantly
short.
Less, you know, there's a lot less of me to push around than you. One guy gave us an idea, which I kind of like, actually. We had this thing recently about how you know, we were part of our sell for the X chair guys. By the way, some of you bought one. Good work.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, that was great.
Keep going. Part of our sell on the X chair is how easy it was to put together to the point where even you could manage it because you are that inept at putting things together. So somebody suggested that you should assemble a piece of furniture for the PFF office, and that could be what we do. I think if we got like
something for, like ridiculous from IKEA,
like a random piece of IKEA crap that I took the instructions away from and just said, go.
I can't take the instructions. Not that the instructions are that much better. They have like the little stick figures there and it's like, oh, do this thing. And it's in Swedish
Something really complicated, you know, where you've just got no shot without the instructions. But like a small desk, you know, and you just take away the instructions and then see, all right, go nuts.
This does not sound
how long will it take?
Look, there's IKEA.
Honestly,
is IKEA a future sponsor? Because I'm about to go to town on IKEA.
The single worst part about that, I don't have any sympathy for you who would spend the rest of the day trying to put something together, but the poor video guy that would have to take 18 hours of footage and edit it together to make it look like it didn't take a week and a half, that would be rough.
While you mentioned X-Chair, we should mention their deal right now. I think the reason why we did have some people buy this week, we got word, because it's $500 off. Working from home is more important than ever right now, and optimizing your home office with an X-Chair or their many accessories to enhance your focus, productivity, energy, and comfort. Sounds like a really good idea to me. Once you feel the customized support of the X-Chair's patented DVL, that's the dynamic variable lumbar, there's no going back. You get the LMX massage and temperature regulation exclusively designed and made for X-Chair. With versatile comfort and extraordinary design, X-Chair fits any space. I love mine. High performance, quality engineering, extreme comfort. And it's the perfect time to purchase an X-Chair because why? As I said earlier, now's the only time X-Chair goes on sale all year. That's right. Only on Black Friday, Cyber Monday weekend. So you save up to $500 on X-Chair. 4 days only. Oh, shoot. Is it over right now? I hope it's not over. We should still send you over there. Still go over there and see if it's still available. Black Friday, Cyber Monday weekend. We've extended it. I hope X-Chair does too. XChairNFLPod.com. That's where you're going to go. Letter X, Chair, NFLPOD.com. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $25 a month. Go to XChairNFLPod.com. Save up to $500. I hope. XChairNFLPod.com. If you're watching on YouTube, we got
and
all
it's not, if it's not 500, and if they've ended that,
it's at least
our,
100.
Yes, our
it's
link at will at least get you 100 off. There. In addition to the 30-day money-back guarantee, the free shipping, all these kinds of things. So go to our link, buy the X-Chair. They are ridiculously comfortable, and yet we are still perched on these ridiculous bar stools in here because this desk is really
we
high.
Need X-Chair to get us one more. Just like the, is there a bar stool X-Chair?
A bar stool X-Chair. They have that crazy looking like spaceship pod that looks pretty yeah, cool.
We didn't get those.
Can we get one of those? How much are they? I haven't checked.
I have not checked.
Pull up the website, find out how much the pod costs because that thing looks pretty badass.
Why does this guy want us to do a podcast in full clown outfits, makeup and all? That's no fun for anybody.
I mean, it's probably fun for some people. There's a lot of people that there's like an actual phobia that people have about clowns, right? We might freak some people out if we do that.
I thought a fun one a couple years ago. Remember the Dallas radio folks
Look.
Oh, that thing looks ridiculous.
I'm guessing that's not cheap.
That I don't know like if that's it. A part of the $500 off.
I don't know either. But there you go. Shop now. Let's see.
Yeah. I mean, $500 off $6,500. You get this for a cool $6,000.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
XChairNFLPod.com.
Yes.
The folks from one of the Dallas radio stations a couple years ago, remember the guy lost a bet and he had to wear like a full football uniform the entire week at the Super Bowl on Radio Row. I feel like something like that could be good. Since we're 2-2 right now, it wouldn't be like, oh, it's got to be Steve, it's got to be Sam. Maybe it ends up being a bet. You're a big, let's do a bet, and loser does something ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That could be the next thing. Maybe we both compete. We have like competing charities or something.
Yeah, there are a lot
like
of people that.
That
are suggesting some form of competition version, which is I think is fair. Some people have suggested that you should try and field punts in a full uniform. I kind of like that. I think that's pretty funny.
So we call the Bengals and just go down to the
stadium. We borrow your punter and your stadium.
Yeah. I mean, if we can get into the University of Cincinnati, I'm sure
UC,
we can get in.
We can go to UC as well.
Andre loved us. Andre loved letting us in 5 o'clock on a Friday night.
We're sorry, Andre. I think that would be pretty funny. A lot of people also want to see a repeat of me covering you playing football to basically prove that you
kind of like going out on top.
Prove that your one-off lucky shot was a
one-off
lucky shot.
There's video footage of me torching you for 50 plus yards.
Uh-huh.
Great throw.
I don't want
to get Bruce down here, and he's probably so inaccurate right now throwing me.
You of all people are going to be the person criticizing throwing accuracy based off the video evidence that we just had.
Yeah, that's correct.
Of you not being able to get it near the plate.
Because I know what it's like when you haven't played in a few years.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to. I don't want Bruce to go through that embarrassment either.
Wow. Also, some other guy said that based off the video of our stare down, where it's like,
yeah.
He said, based off that, he withdraws his request that the challenge be an Oklahoma drill between the two of us. I find that personally insulting. I think I would be fine with an Oklahoma drill.
Again, maybe he's saying that because low man wins and pad level.
He's saving you, is what you're saying. Okay, fair enough.
Pad level would not be in my favor, and that could hurt.
There are a lot of people that I would not want to have any part of tackling. You're not one of them. I have no problem with that. I'm okay.
These are fun. So, yes, there's the stare down. Look at that. Yeah, Oklahoma drill wouldn't be good.
And look, people are also taking this to be like, I'm 4 foot two. I am 5'11 in height. You just happen to be freakishly proportioned.
6'10. 6'10 over
allegedly.
Here, with that Don Sutton hair poking through.
So this is not a reflection of my height. This is a reflection of your height, which doesn't necessarily come across on the in this podcast studio where we're both sitting on bar stools.
So keep NFLpodcast@pff.com. So keep emailing us and love the suggestions. And again, we've got, two emails that have gotten the wheels turning for us and fueled this episode here today. Right?
Today, yeah.
So let's go back to Monday Night Football first, and then we'll get to those. We'll get to some of those emails.
All right.
Sound good?
Yep.
So Washington football team 17-15 over the Seattle Seahawks. The Seahawks offense only scored those 13 points because they had a kick two, a return for 2 points on a blocked extra point. The football team's rolling as you called earlier in the year. They're making their Super Bowl push here. Sam.
Exactly as I predicted. You know, a late season run with Taylor Heinicke at quarterback. All the way to the Super Bowl. Now, admittedly, the Taylor Heinicke thing started earlier than I'd anticipated. I think I predicted that happening in the wild card round or maybe week 17 or something. He's been in there since, what, week 2? So it's been – that part has been earlier. But other than that, it's right on track. All I need now is for them to win out, and we're good.
They are currently the number 7 seed. Is that correct? I think I said that the other day. They would win the tiebreaker at the moment.
Right.
They don't have the best odds, I don't believe, on PFF.com as far as making it. But the football team has had this.
They're getting better, though, obviously.
Yeah. Look, they started 2-6 last year as well. Remember, they started out slow. They beat the Steelers on like the Tuesday or Wednesday night game, whatever it was, because of COVID.
We currently have them with a 34% chance of making the playoffs. We have them with a 16% chance of winning the division still.
So there's still a chance because of all those division games that you've cited here a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And the football team has had this knack. Remember, this started 2 weeks ago with their win over the Tampa Bay Bucks, where they get the ball in the fourth quarter with a one-score lead, and they run the rest of the clock out. A 10-minute drive. And they were doing similar stuff against Seattle. They had multiple 8-plus-minute drives. They are getting into this groove of like, if I need a 5-yard pass, I'm going to make a 5-yard pass. And also from a run game perspective, just picking up what they need. Really impressive how the football team has played in shortening games in that way.
And look, the PFF power rankings, which you can find on the website, PFF.com, you go to the betting tab up top, and then the drop down there will give you power rankings. Those are based off 10,000 simulations of the season from here on in, right? I have done my own simulation.
Of course.
Singular.
You updated this.
Yes. Where, you go through and you pick all the games week by week, how you think they're going to go, and then it spits you out what's going to happen at the end of it.
Of course.
I have Washington making the playoffs in my simulation. So, 30 whatever it was percent.
It's 100% in your simulation. It's 33% in PFFs.
So it's somewhere between the 30% and the 100%.
Of course.
Which means they're definitely making the playoffs. I had them making the playoffs at 9-8 with the 7th seed.
I trust your view.
And they can do that, I think, whilst losing to Dallas. So they don't even need to do anything crazy for that to happen.
Well, I trust your assessment here.
So I mean, look.
Whatever you've got going here.
The man with the simulation is the one that's always right. And I have a simulation. I mean, you don't have a simulation.
I do not.
So what would you know?
I should go run and I'll go do the simulation as well.
Okay.
Anyway, Taylor Heinicke playing a cleaner brand of football in recent weeks. They're running the ball extremely well. The offensive line has been fantastic this year, and they've dealt with some injuries. They were down to a third-string center the other night after Wes Schweitzer got hurt. Chase Roullier has been out for the season, but Eric Flowers, Charles Leno, Brandon Scherff, Cornelius Lucas, all playing pretty well, and that has been the strength of this team. And I keep going back to Ron Rivera as well. I don't think it's tough to pinpoint coaches who are like legitimate difference makers. We might have a bunch who are just young and they're at the start of their career. Ron Rivera kind of has a history of elevating his teams. And that was one of the reasons why I liked the football team and wasn't – I was surprised at last year's run. But I think when you went back and looked at last year's run, you said, okay, he made this not-so-talented-looking football team, literally football team, look much better and elevated them. And I think we're starting to see the Ron Rivera influence as well in this little 3-game stretch that they're on.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the defense is not as catastrophic as it was earlier in the season, where they were giving up a big play every week.
Much like the Chiefs. So like, should we have just known, hey, they can't be this bad for this long?
I think we did.
We cited that a lot.
We certainly said it with the Chiefs that, hey, look, they have faced a gauntlet of really good offenses, and they're not as bad as they look. I think the same thing was true with Washington, that there were a lot of numbers that suggested that their defense should not possibly be as bad as it was. And at some point, it will get slightly better than that. The question is how much. So Washington's defense making steps in the right direction is important. Taylor Heinicke playing slightly better is important. And then playing Russell Wilson with mallet finger was also quite important.
I do feel like the mallet finger shows up when he tries to zip it.
You think?
Yeah.
You're telling me that having a bolt taken out of his finger like a couple of weeks ago will actually affect the way he throws the football.
Now, is his finger injury worse than, say, the thumb that Drew Brees had last year? And then who else had one? Which other quarterback just had one this year, had an issue with their hand and missed time and has come back? I don't know why I can't remember off the top of my head, but someone else just dealt with that, right? Not mallet finger exactly, but a finger injury that has affected them.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, I mean, Russ's decision-making, bad turnover-worthy play over the middle of the field yesterday or Monday night. I'm trying to figure out how much is all. Tua had a finger injury a couple weeks ago, so it wasn't as bad, didn't have surgery, but he's come back and, you know, completed a bunch of passes. How much of, we don't really know what Seattle is in this new offense, right? Because before Russ got hurt, he was grading pretty well, but the offense was really, really dependent on these big throws. Like, if you used EPA in a vacuum, they were, I think, one of the more efficient offenses in the league. But if you looked at the number of plays with positive EPA, again, that's expected points added. It's basically, is it a successful play or not? Their successful play rate was low, but overall EPA was high, which suggests there's a bunch of deep passes and big plays that are skewing the numbers here, which isn't a bad thing necessarily, but it's like that's going to regress a little bit. So I don't know what this Shane Waldron offense is yet either. And I think they've been a little bit too either big play dependent, and the underneath stuff or the intermediate stuff, really, that 10 to 19 range has not been great for Seattle. So I also don't know if we have enough answers there combined with over the last 3 weeks. Yeah, Russ is recovering from the finger injury.
Yeah. I think all that is true. But this idea of, you know, Wilson Rank is one of the greatest healers in the history of anything might not be that true. Like, he documented his injury, right, with his own, like, video team and all this kind of stuff. And there were some fairly graphic images of exactly what was involved in this finger recovery. And there were, like, pieces of metal inserted into this finger in a fairly structural-looking way that were eventually, you know, removed. And then, oh, he's good to go now. This is... You're throwing hand with that kind of degree of invasive procedure involved. I can only imagine you would struggle throwing the ball the way you used to for years whilst recovering for that. So I think Wilson, it's going to take him a while to get back to where he was. And it's one of those things where it might not, you know, show up every single snap, and it doesn't necessarily explain. It's harder to imagine how a hurt finger can lead to you making dumb decisions. But I think when it's something that something you've never had to think about before is suddenly there in the periphery of everything you do, it makes the other things worse.
So as a big throw it out guy,
yeah,
are you throwing this out?
For what purposes?
Evaluating, I think there are some serious questions about the future of the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah.
From a front office standpoint, from a coaching standpoint, from a Russell Wilson standpoint, they right now, they have the fourth overall pick in the draft. But wait, they don't. They traded it for Jamal Adams.
Oh.
It's the Jets. Right, they would have the fourth overall pick right now.
Which they could really use about now.
Which they could really use right now. And so I think there are some serious questions about Russ, the quarterback, too. So even if you want to throw out the three mallet finger games, go back to week 9 of last year, because we also love that, too. Hard cutoffs. Russ goes from this 95 overall grade through the first 8 weeks of 2020, drops off from week 9 through the playoffs with a 70 grade. He was number 20th. Let me add the playoffs in here, actually. The number 19 graded quarterback last year from week 9 through the end of the season. Add in early this season where he did play well, but he's still barely a top 15 quarterback from a grading standpoint. Is that a concern? Because I think Seattle's been great in part because he's been able to elevate a team that has slowly, slowly, slowly been depleted from a roster standpoint over the years.
He's gone back to being the Russell Wilson from before the kind of 2 year stretch where he was like one of the top two or three. Remember there was that couple of year period where he elevated his game and he went from being really good to literally as good as any quarterback in the NFL. Before that, he was hovering, like he had that, his very first grade was a 90 in 2012, his rookie year, which is insane, right? A rookie quarterback rating at 90. But then, like, the next, what, 3, 4, 5 years were more or less between, more or less around 80, between 83, 78, or 74.5. That was his kind of level, which was really good. It's a good place to be, but it's not Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes, those kinds of guys. And then 2018, that jumped up to 89. 2019, it was 92. 2020, 90.5. And as you said, that was very much a first half of the season was incredible. Second half of the season, pretty crappy. And then this year, we're back down to that 74 level. And the 74 includes mallet finger, you know, where he hasn't been playing as well. So effectively, what you're looking at is Russell Wilson has gone back to being the guy he was before that 2.5 year stretch where he was as good as any quarterback in the league.
But last year in 10 games, it was a 72.5.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's like that, a split. So it's 2.5 seasons where he was as good as anything. And then last year, the second half of the season, and this year, he's gone back to being the guy that he was.
Hey guys, life is full of questions. Like, what would happen to my family if something happened to me? Am I saving enough for retirement? And is now the right time to start thinking about life insurance? Just to name a few. No one should have to settle for answers to these life-altering questions that involve gray areas or leaving things to chance. And with Western and Southern, you won't have to. Backed by over 130 years of experience gathering insights, building strategies, and helping customers choose the right solutions, together we can look ahead to leave the unknown behind. Western and Southern Financial Group, life insurance, retirement, and investments.
Compensated endorser, products issued by member companies of Western and Southern Financial Group, Cincinnati, Ohio.
The other interesting point here with Russell Wilson is we've tried to explain away here on the podcast for years, why doesn't Seattle trust Russell Wilson, right? Why don't they trust him as much? Why don't they let Russ cook? That was the big tagline last year. Why aren't they throwing the ball 40 or 50 times instead of establishing the run and working play action? And we've heard through the years to, you know, you don't know what you're going to get from him on a week-to-week basis if you're the offensive coordinator. Now, I thought there was a stretch where that was much better, but I'm talking about seeing the field, decision-making on underneath stuff, taking the easy stuff. In a play-action-driven system where it's like two deep route concepts, pick one, you know, hit a guy in stride down the field, Russ is as good as it gets. But when you're not as protected in that sense, he's far less consistent, right? And again, he's not bad necessarily, but I don't think it's as clean as telling him, go play like Brady, go play like Breeze, go play like Rodgers, be the guy, take over the game, it's all going to run through you. We've seen it in individual games here and there, but not consistently enough. So I bring all that up to say, you know, if he ended up in Washington or Denver or Houston or whatever next year, Miami, what are they going to get? You know, is Pete Carroll the guy that's been able to foster that relationship of Russ and whoever the offensive coordinator is and getting the most out of him? I'm trying to position this the right way. Will other teams know how to use him? Will they know what they're getting into? Is Russ as hot of a commodity? Our friend Kev Cole on Unexpected Points has been tweeting this week. Is Russ as big of a commodity as Matthew Stafford on the which I think is a crazy question on the surface, because I think Russ has had a much better career. But given the downturn right here, would NFL teams covet Russell Wilson as much as they would covet Matthew Stafford last year?
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable question. Like,
we'll spend a lot of offseason time talking about it, of course.
There's always been an element that the narrative, the dynamic has always been portrayed as Russell Wilson is like one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, and this like idiot Pete Carroll has been dragging him down and not just letting him cook and not turning the ball over to him and saying, go win us the games, trying to like hold him back and, you know, drag him down with the run game and all these kinds of things. I think there's always been an element to which that was definitely not a fair characterization of that relationship, and there's definitely a degree to which Russell Wilson doesn't help Russell Wilson as much as he could, you know. And that idea of when you let Andrew Luck was this quarterback who put everything on his shoulders, tried to make a hero play every single time, and his career was kind of characterized by putting out the fire that he himself started earlier in the day, you know, which is, it's better than letting the house burn down, but it's probably not as good as the guy that never set fire to the curtains in the first place. I think there's an element to which Russell Wilson, when the Colts eventually helped him out and said, hey, look, Andrew, you're going to get the ball out of your hands quicker. We're going to give you a bunch of free, easy plays. And, you know, when things go to hell, you can still make the house saving, you know, put out the fire kind of deal later on. And he was way better. Like, that was the best Andrew Luck. I think there's a degree to which Russell Wilson skews in that direction. Not quite the same style, but won't take the kind of easy things a lot of the time, and won't just take the, you know, you never go broke taking a profit kind of attitude, and then always tries to play hero ball. And that, I think, is part of this don't let Russ cook kind of thing that has been happening, is some of that is on Russell Wilson. And I suspect that if he ends up going somewhere else, or they blow it up or whatever, like, we're probably going to see that it doesn't all go away if you just separate Russell Wilson from Pete Carroll.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Patrick in the YouTube comments suggests that the Giants will overpay for Russ. I mean, the Giants are an interesting spot because I think Russell Wilson is, there are a lot of quarterbacks who are very aware of their brand and their legacy. He sounds like, I mean, Tom Brady clearly cares about he has a legitimate brand called, yes, TB12, right? He cares about his brand and his legacy. And I thought Kirk Cousins, when he was a free agent a couple years ago, made a very calculated decision to play in a dome with good receivers and all this stuff. Russ seems like he'd be very calculated in that respect. And big city, bright lights. And hey, I've played behind a bad offensive line before. They can reconstruct that in front of my eyes, but there's some good playmakers there. I think the Giants would be an intriguing team.
Yeah.
For Russell Wilson. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but then you have a team like the Browns, who are in the middle of Andrew Berry, their general manager, with some, this is like your boss basically coming out saying, "Got an important few weeks here. You got a very important few weeks here, son. If you want to get paid, we need you to play through injury, Baker, and play well." I mean, the Browns, there are a lot of teams that might have decisions to make on Daniel Jones in New York, on Baker Mayfield in Cleveland. And if Russ is out there, as much as we're saying, is it over in Seattle? Other teams would be sprinting to line up to get Russell Wilson.
Yeah, some very pointed comments from Andrew Berry, which is why I've been saying for a while that if you're Baker Mayfield and you want to maximize the contract that you're going to receive next, you should shut yourself down.
You're crazy.
Because
that's part of the evaluation. Because Andrew's also saying you got to play hurt. You're healthy enough to play through it, lead us to victories.
Yeah, but he isn't healthy enough to play. Like, that's the thing.
He's been cleared to play, so he's healthy
different.
Enough to play.
Like, being having a doctor being prepared to sign off on the risk of you going out there and playing with a wrecked shoulder is different to I am healthy enough to go out there and play well, which is the bottom line here. Like, Baker Mayfield could easily be shut down for the season to get his repair a torn labrum
in his non-throwing shoulder,
and nobody would bat an eyelid.
It's going to come
really
across.
Would. It now
would
they
come
would.
Across if he went, like he was protecting himself for his contract,
which would be entirely fair from his point of view. Like, why should he be expected to play like crap for the next 14 games from when he injured that thing, so that you can get a cheaper contract out of him and maybe have a better chance to win versus Case Keenum? And absolutely torpedo the poor guy's next contract. Like, why is that fair? How is that the bargain here? He's wrecked his shoulder. He's got multiple other injuries he's dealing with. And every game he plays takes a zero off the end of the contract he's receiving. It's ridiculous. He should shut himself down and say, I was prepared to give it a shot as long as we were going to be fair about this. But if you're saying, not only do I expect you to go out there and play hurt, but I expect you to go out there and play well hurt. Otherwise, we're not interested in future. Like, what kind of crap is that?
Because Andrew Berry's also out there saying, hey, nobody's healthy here in December. And the expectation is...
Sure, but there are guys out there significantly more healthy than the dude who has a fully torn labrum at his shoulder.
Maybe next year he doesn't have a fully torn labrum, but he's got other injuries that he's got to play through. You still have that expectation that he can go out there and play. And clearly the Browns are looking at him saying, we think 75% of Baker Mayfield's better than Case Keenum, or at least we have to believe that, so we're going to roll with you. You know, that... It's part of the job, being able to play through that. Didn't Brady have like a torn MCL or something last year and led the Bucs to the Super Bowl? He could have shut it down too.
There's plenty of quarterbacks that have been shut down for less injuries than what Baker's dealing with right now. All I'm saying is you have your GM, the guy that you're negotiating with, which is probably part of this, by the way. You have your GM essentially coming out here and saying what you're doing right now for our benefit is costing you money with this next contract. That's a pretty tough thing to be dealing with, in addition to just trying to get ready for the next game and being better than you were last time. I think the dude, for his own benefit, should shut himself down, but he isn't. He's not that kind of player. He's clearly going to grit it out and play through it and cost himself a lot of cash.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I don't know that you're necessarily wrong in that whatever happens in these next few games will will determine a lot of this.
But absolutely, the Browns are going to be looking at all available options, which may well include Russell Wilson.
It may. It's going to be a fun offseason because of all that stuff. I need this plug plugged in. Something not plugged in here?
Who knows?
I don't want my computer to die on me.
That would be a shame.
Anyway, football fans, I'm sure we all love an action-packed, high-scoring NFL game, but with the latest no-brainer from DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. You'll be a winner once a single point is scored. New customers who bet just $1 on any team to score can win $100 in free bets. It's that simple. If Sportsbook isn't yet available in your state, you can still get in on the NFL action. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes all season long with DraftKings daily fantasy sports contests. And DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with their first deposit. So all you have to do, download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code PFF. Bet $1 on any team to score and win $100 in free bets. If they score, you score with promo code PFF this week at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or older, New Jersey, Indiana, or Pennsylvania only. New customers only. Minimum $5 deposit and $1 wager required. One per customer. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. All right, Sam, we're going
to
have...
If your computer dies, then you won't have the ad reads, and I'll have to do them. So all of a sudden, I don't want your computer to die either.
Open up that doc just in case. Yeah. The only other one we have is Cyber 40. 40% off.
We're good. I can do that.
So that's easy enough, right? Just tell people we have 40% off on PFF subscriptions over at PFF.com. That's all you have to do.
An email came in, by the way, while we've been live from Jeremy Roel. This is an idea that might get you, killed. Steve has to stand on a busy street corner in Cincinnati during rush hour for 15 minutes wearing the PFF Gardner Minshew shirt and telling passersby some of your favorite phrases like, hey, let's all creep back toward average and throw the damn ball. That feels like, how you end up with video evidence of Steve's murder.
You know, I think he's suggesting I'm on the sidewalk, right? Not in the the middle of a crosswalk or something.
Like, one of those people with the big signs that goes walking,
So if you get a big PFF NFL podcast
billboard
sign with our logo on it, with our heads, and I'll flip it around and, honk for the PFF NFL podcast, and I'm just going to yell catchphrases at them.
Yeah.
But he suggested you join me too and say you're Joe Flacco, right?
I'm going to choose to ignore that part.
Yeah, he wants you there too.
But I think it'd be funnier just to see you in a big sandwich.
You'll just yell out fundamentally, right?
Yeah.
Or did you cut that out of your? You cut that out recently.
I mean, I've been trying to. I don't know how successful it's been.
So we'll just go with all of our catchphrases. That wouldn't be bad.
Not a bad one.
Be good for the podcast too.
I mean, look, it's your bodily harm you're risking, and I'm okay with that. So.
I'm at least on the sidewalk, right? Flipping this on.
You're also large. You've got that like intimidation factor for the people that don't like big people.
Yeah,
there's a swathe,
you don't think they'll run me over because I'm big?
I'm just saying there's a swathe of society that would not engage you in physical pain because of your size.
Right.
Immediately. So you cut out a chunk of those people that if you were a small person, they would immediately come and slap you in the head.
There's a lot of people who might just think they like to fight the big guy. I thought you were saying I was going to get run over. But then it's you don't want to like run your car into a moose. You might damage the car. So I might have that going for me. Nobody wants to run me over. They might damage the car. So,
Yeah, I hadn't compared you to a moose before, but it's actually oddly fitting.
No, I'm creeping back toward moose size right now in my as I head into my 40s. You want to read these emails?
Yeah, let's go. What do we got?
Steve from Buffalo. Are you going to read this?
Sure. Yes, so Steve from Buffalo is the guy that essentially wants you to explain what in God's name you're talking about when you say big-time throws and turnover-worthy plays, for that matter. He really likes some of the stats, but he has a few questions. Is a big-time throw any skillful throw? Does the situation matter? An 11-yard completion on first and 10 the first quarter is different than an 11-yard TD throw to clinch a game or even an 11-yard down to continue a game-winning drive, blah, 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 blah. I'm going to edit some of these on the fly. Are there ever any big time throws or are there ever any big time throws on turnover worthy plays? A ball goes through the hands of a DB for a big play. Does a turnover worthy play only occur when a defender drops an interception or a fumble recovered by the fumbling team? So let's cover that part as well. He also has a second part that's an interesting different question, but let's cover this one.
So what is a big time throw essentially?
And a turnover worthy play.
Okay, so it all starts with the PFF grading system, which is always -2 to +2 on every single play. And I know we've explained some of this before, but it's always good to rehash it. We have a very specific rubric for what a 0.5 looks like. So in our You know, when somebody's trained up, you know, you've obviously been trained up and I've been trained up, and we can go to Ben Stockwell and we can go to any other PFF analyst and say, is this a plus 0.5 to you or a zero? Is this a plus 0.5 or a one? And we're kind of speaking the same language. So anything that gets a plus one or better, one, 1.5 or a two, we just kind of eye through into this big time throw bucket. And I think it's a great name, BTTs, to isolate those plays. So the example of, say, an 11-yard throw or 11-yard first down on first and 10 early in the game versus late in the game, almost always like the same throw will get a 0.5. Every now and again, we do have the ability to kind of like up the ante on a, you know, late game clincher or something like that. The best example is the Eli Manning to Mario Manningham Super Bowl pass along the sideline in between double coverage, right on his hands on the game winning drive. Like, that was a plus two. That was as good of a throw as we've ever seen. But so anything that's plus one or better.
But the down and distance thing is kind of baked into the original grade, you know. So a first and 10 throw versus a third and 10 throw that moves the chains is not necessarily the same thing. Yeah. Like the that part of it, the down and distance and the importance of moving the chains is sort of baked into the original number. And then there is scope for the Mario Manninghams of insane game situation to bump that even higher.
The other example I'll use here too is, so the window of the pass matters, and it doesn't mean we're like encouraging quarterbacks to throw the ball into double coverage, but I think the way to look at it, so Kirk Cousins had even though he didn't have a great overall game on Sunday, his touchdown, one of his touchdowns to Adam Thielen was fourth and two, back of the end zone. There were underneath defenders. There was a defender on Thielen. He throws it up and away from coverage. That was a shorter big time throw. So you might see more big time throws in the 10, 11, 12 yard range, even a little bit shorter, in the red zone because the window is so tight, and we'll bump those up a little bit. But I think one of the ways to describe it, it's great timing, accuracy, general ball location, and so everything is generally pretty good there. And the other way to describe it is it gives you the opportunity for a big play. So because we're grading every player on every play, there is a difference between, say, there's a busted coverage and you throw the ball 40 yards up in the air to a wide open guy. Right, good job recognizing the busted coverage and all that stuff, but like the defense gave that to you. That might just be a 0.5 for us. If you throw the ball 40 yards in the air and it's over the corner and it's before the safety gets there and you put it right on the hands of the receiver who maybe didn't separate all that great, or the defense didn't blow it and give you this great opportunity, you're essentially creating this opportunity. As a quarterback, you're creating this big play opportunity for your team. Therefore, it's better. So it'll get a higher grade. So great timing, accuracy down the field. They're generally going to be 15-plus yard passes, and the further you get, the more credit you'll get.
And we're grading the process, not the results. So,
right.
You know, a dropped pass at the end of a big-time throw doesn't change the big-time throw. The big-time throw will get graded that way, even if his receiver drops it at the end. And that's why, so one of the questions here was, you know, are there any big-time throws on turnover-worthy plays? So, you know, if the ball goes through the hands of a defensive back but is then caught by the receiver for a big play, no, because the process there is the throw was to a defensive back who then ended up conspiring not to catch it. That would probably be a turnover-worthy play, you know, barring any other mitigating circumstances. The fact that the DB screwed it up and it goes through and is caught by the receiver, that's a really good play for the offense, right? It ends up moving the chains, it ends up being a big play and is massive for the team's chances of winning. But the quarterback on that play was bad. He threw the ball to a defensive back who didn't catch it and should have been punished. And the reason we do that in terms of grading is because the process thing is the most predictive element. If you have a quarterback that's throwing the ball consistently to corners, even if they drop them 10 times in a row, the point is he's throwing it consistently to corners. And in the future, unless you give him a reason not to do that, he's going to keep throwing it to corners. And ultimately, that guy will be a bad quarterback. The fact that, you know, in a game of sample sizes like football, luck can kind of shine, Lady Luck can shine her eye on a quarterback for a while and not punish him for bad plays doesn't change the fact that he's playing badly.
So you can have a big-time throw that becomes a turnover, but the definition big time throw or turnover worthy play is based off the process. It's based off the grade, not the result. And that's why Brady on Monday Night Football a couple weeks ago was a good example too. He threw an interception on a non-turnover worthy play to Mike Evans on a screen, and then Brady's best pass of the game was a big time throw to Breshad Perriman that he put on his hands in the end zone and he drops it. And again, I always try to reiterate too, I think PFF, we're the only system that I think properly views those two plays. QBR takes, you know, they acknowledge drops, but I think you still get a little bit of a downgrade for throwing that interception on a drop. And it acknowledges maybe Breshad Perriman dropped the pass from Brady, but you're not getting the same exact credit as you would if he had caught it. We're giving the same exact credit no matter what happens at the end of the play, whether it's dropped or not. So that's why EPA obviously doesn't account for that, because that's just a broad, like, Brady got horrible negative EPA for the interception that was completely Mike Evans' fault. So again, when you're attaching EPA to a player, I think things get skewed, especially in really small sample sizes. QBR is not accounting for it. No traditional stats, EPA, nothing's accounting for it, quite like the PFF grade. Some of the other questions about like 3rd and 8 and 3rd and 10, a lot of it's just like when you hit a deep out. Joe Burrow had a deep out the other day, right? It was a layered deep out from the far hash. It was 15 yards, and it was perfect on the sideline to T. Higgins. It was a pass. Again, it's not even really an open throw, and Joe Burrow made it an open throw. We called that a big-time throw because it's a deep out, 15 yards. Another 15-yard deep out might be single coverage. The receiver creates a ton of separation. You just kind of throw it out there. It's catchable. It's not, you know, right on him. And that might just be a 0.5. So it's kind of differentiating between how much the quarterback is contributing to the production on a given play.
Okay. Let's skip ahead to the next email. This one from Andrew Bowl. Hi, guys. Question is, essentially, can the Packers continue to overcome the constant string of injuries they've been suffering? So far this season, Aaron Rodgers, Aaron Jones, Davante Adams, Alan Lazard, Marquez Valdes-Scantling, Josh Myers, Rashawn Gary, Eric Stokes, Preston Smith, Kevin King, Jair Alexander. Have all missed games with injuries. Robert Tonyan, Whitney Merciless, Elton Jenkins are all out for the year. They haven't had David Bakhtiari yet and barely had Za'Darius Smith with just 18 snaps in week one. At some point, do they reach a critical mass of injuries that they just can't overcome anymore?
I mean, I think if you're talking about in the playoffs, yes. It is an impressive effort, and I think that's why so many people are high on Matt LaFleur as coach of the year. On the other hand, I would say if you look at – so if you go up and down the Packers' most impressive wins, maybe the 49ers in week three, they win 30-28, but the 49ers, they weren't the same team back then, maybe right. That they are now. The Steelers team in week four, again – not one of the better teams in the world. I mean, the Bengals win in week five, which was literally a play here and there in their favor. That ends up becoming a pretty good win. Of course, the Cardinals, a depleted Packers team, goes and beats the Cardinals. But even that was like, I mean, Kyler Murray threw a game-winning touchdown. The receiver just decided not to turn around and catch it in A.J. Green. I mean, that is the fine line that has the Packers at 9-3 here and right up there. Right behind the Cardinals for the number one seed, the Seahawks. This was Russell Wilson's return from mallet finger, and they scored only 17 points in that particular game. They lose to the Vikings, and then, yeah, very impressive win against a Rams team that is falling apart just a little bit. So I think overall I've been impressed with what the Packers have done. I do think when you get into a playoff situation, though, and you got to play either teams at full strength or the Bucs or, you know, the Cowboys, whichever good team you're going to run into in the playoffs, I think it eventually comes back to bite unless a lot of these guys come back healthy.
Yeah, I mean, so three teams I think have been impressive this year in terms of navigating real setbacks with injuries. I think the Packers are one of them. I think Arizona is another one, dealing without their quarterback and without their number one receiver for a stretch of games. And then Tennessee are the other one, and Tennessee, it's finally kind of catching up with them now. I think injuries, obviously anytime you lose a ton of players, it's not good. But I think the real problems come when they're concentrated in one area. And if they're not, and if you look at Green Bay's, okay, they've had an absolute ton of them, but generally they have been spread out. You know, they've you lose Jair Alexander, you lose Za'Darius Smith, you lose David Bakhtiari. Like, they have generally managed to avoid the kind of crippling injury hits to one specific position, right? Like, if they had lost Jair Alexander and then Eric Stokes and then Kevin King, and all of a sudden you're down to like number four at five as your starting cornerbacks, that's where you have a real problem. And at wide receiver, if they'd lost Davante Adams and Marquez Valdes-Scantling and Alan Lazard, again, all of a sudden you're screwed. The offensive line, they've gotten pretty close. Like, they haven't had Bakhtiari all year. Elgton Jenkins was doing really well at left tackle. Now he's down. They are down to like a third string at best left tackle, and at least have held up well for a game. But that's the kind of thing where I think it can cause real problems over a period of time. And if they don't get David Bakhtiari back pretty quickly, that feels like the kind of thing that could actually derail their season. But other than that, I think they can actually keep weathering this as long as those injuries don't hit at the same spot. And the concern is now you're so thin, you don't have that buffer room anymore. So if one guy goes down at a position where one or two guys have already gone down, now you're back into that crisis mode. Like, they're one injury now, essentially, from that kind of crisis at any given position.
And the offensive line injuries last year hurt the Packers in the conference championship game against the Bucks. They had Billy Turner forced to play left tackle, and he got beat up a little bit. The run blocking wasn't great in that particular game. It did kind of catch up. I will say, our preseason narrative, though, that they were so dependent on Aaron Rodgers, Devontae Adams, and Jair Alexander, maybe they've...
Yeah.
We could look at it from the other lens and say, okay, they have answered that problem.
Absolutely.
Right? Because they've won games despite Aaron Rodgers. You know, they've won games because of him. They've won games despite him. They've won games with defense. I do love that. When you watch a team win in different ways, I do feel much better about them going forward.
The Chiefs last year, I think, are a good example of where you just at some point reach critical mass when all the injuries are concentrated in one spot. Like, their offensive line had been banged up all season long. They've been losing guys left, right, and center. Like, week after week, another guy goes down. But it wasn't until they lost Eric Fisher in the conference championship game that was it. Like, that was the tipping point. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. And all of a sudden, you get to the Super Bowl, and it's like, wow, the Chiefs have the worst offensive line in the NFL. Well, they only have one player different than it was a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, rather. You know what I mean? But that was the one. That was the final straw too far, or the bridge too far for this line to keep functioning. Green Bay they've had a lot of injuries along the offensive line, but they've just about patched it together at this point. But I would say they are like one, or they're an injury away from maybe that offensive line completely collapsing.
We have some other smart questions coming through in the YouTube chat, more about our grading system and everything. One question about considering ball placement on yards after the catch, or you know, fueling yards after the catch. I would say through the years, I think we've learned that yards after the catch are mostly a product of how open a receiver is. So it's more the receiver versus the defense. The ball location does matter. It absolutely does. It shows up in our QB and our throw and our accuracy grades. So we do actually have accuracy that says he put this on the front number, he put it on the back shoulder, he put it on this frame.
And also,
we do consider all that.
And it does show up in the grading as well, if depending on the severity. So,
right.
You know, the difference in ball location between like right here, perfectly out in, you know, on your hands, slightly out in front of you, exactly where you want it for, 100% optimal yards after the catch, and a pass that's like here, you know, a foot and a half behind you, that's not ideal but is perfectly catchable, that's not going to change your grade. But if the difference between like the perfect pass and the one that makes you stop and like, you know, check your run and have to go back and get it, and it's still technically catchable, it still technically moves the chains, but it 100% costs you 10 yards after the catch, that will change the grade on the throw.
And we will downgrade both the quarterback and the receiver sometimes on a drop, say, you know, an inaccurate pass that's dropped that should still be caught. We can dock the receiver. We could also dock the quarterback. All I'll say is I think the grading is very intelligent when it comes to that. Like, we have leeway to make those adjustments. The key is consistency, though, is to try to if you turn on the tape in week one versus week 12 or back in 2014, saying, here's this 0.5, here are 0.5 throws from 10 to 19 yards, they'll all kind of like look similar, right? And then there's also other adjustments that happen based off of difficulty and, you know, to normalize things and kind of set it up against expectations. So I think it is a pretty smart grading system, and that's why it's been shown to be the most consistent, especially when it comes to quarterback play, offensive line play, and a whole bunch of other areas. So that's my pitch right there.
Nice.
Which makes me also say, go Cyber 40 right now. Go get your 40% off for all these grades and stats, which are really smart and intelligent, Sam. 40% off anything over at PFF.com. I'm not trying to, you know, I don't want to come across defensive or anything. I'm just trying to say we do a good job, I think, in the grading, describing what happened on the field.
Yeah. So people have used like touchdown to interception ratio for years. Big time throw to turnover-worthy plays is just, it's a proxy for that, and it's a much more nuanced and accurate version, because you are stripping out all those plays where, you know, somebody asked this, and honestly, it's something we should probably do. Like the idea of, why do we not have a statistic that's like non-quarterback fault interceptions? You know what I mean? And we do kind of like indirectly, we can come up with that number, but that should just be a number. Like,
yeah,
quarterback, like Tom Brady, 9 interceptions, 3 non-quarterback interceptions, yeah, or whatever. We should have that nailed somewhere.
But, yeah, it wouldn't be bad to have it directly next to it,
right,
just to give that context. So we threw 9, and there's 2 drops, there's a Hail Mary, there's whatever in, yeah, there, yeah, and you deduct those.
But the point is, the big-time throws and the turnover-worthy plays, they kind of strip out those noisy plays that are not on the quarterback, and they add back in a bunch that were on the quarterback and aren't necessarily counted by those box score numbers. So I think they're a much better way of looking at it than the touchdown to interception number, which everyone kind of has used for years as the way of measuring how well the guy is playing.
Anyway, that was all good stuff. 40% off over at PFF.com.
So 40% off.
Big time throw to turnover worthy play ratio, I think, is a great, yeah, I think it's the way you said it, better than touchdown to interception ratio. I'm trying to agree with you here.
Yeah, nice. What's Thursday Night Football this week?
Cowboys Saints.
Okay.
We've got Mike McCarthy in COVID protocol. As we're breaking news here on the show, as we've been live.
Yeah?
Yeah. As we're live here on YouTube, where you can give us that thumbs up. Amari Cooper's been activated from the COVID list for the Dallas Cowboys.
But he's still coughing, so he might not play.
Well, coughing was yesterday. Now he's been activated, so I don't know. Either way, he's been activated for whatever reason. And I don't know. Amari Cooper might be back. That's good for the Cowboys.
Yeah.
If he is. Presumably, CeeDee Lamb will be back this week. We'll see.
Yes, that would be hopeful, rather than spending the next 5 minutes talking about him and then him not showing.
What's Green Line looking at? I haven't looked at the number just yet.
Funny you should ask, Steven. Green Line has a significant edge towards the New Orleans Saints versus the betting line.
So
the
Saints line, are getting 4.5 at,
yes,
home here.
The line is 4.5. Green Line thinks it is significantly closer than that. That's one of the larger edges I've seen, actually, this season for Green Line.
And then Sean Payton is just trying to play like episodic TV producer here. Who's your starting quarterback? We'll see.
Might be Taysom Hill this time.
We'll see. It might be Taysom Hill. Could be Trevor Siemian. We don't know who the starting quarterback will be for the New Orleans Saints. So you got to tune in Monday night, 8:20 on Fox and NFL Network.
Wow.
Find out who is the starting quarterback for the New Orleans Saints. Taysom Hill or Trevor. I won't even say the names because that's not going to entice people.
No.
But we'll find out who the starting quarterback. It could be Drew Brees.
What
if it's Drew Brees?
Sure.
Who would be better? Drew Brees straight out of the booth, Trevor Siemian or Taysom Hill? God, what's the best option?
It's a real question, isn't
it? Or Jameis on one leg?
Not Jameis on one leg.
He's fourth.
He needs two legs to be able to like fling himself backwards to throw the ball.
Or Jameis.
It's not a bad question, though. Like, is Drew Brees straight out of the announcer's booth, presumably has to remove the hair that they gave him.
You can play with the hair on.
You can't play with that on.
Did
under the
Jason
helmet?
Witten keep the hair when
no,
he went back to
when
play,
Jason Witten went back, like it was immediately back to cue ball. You can't rock the tube under the helmet.
Yeah, but he's like in the trenches. He's blocking and all that stuff. Drew's a quarterback. They're
you think
close.
It'll stay cool, calm, and collected under the helmet? Those things like...
Yeah, it would be rough for the post-game.
You've seen Manning takes his helmet off and there's those like big, you know, red circles on his head when that thing pushes into his fore. Like,
true.
You can't rock a toupee under that.
Then he throws it back on, back in the
booth.
For
the interview?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a real question. Like, if he showed up tomorrow and was like, coach, put me in, I can play, would he be better than the options that they currently have?
I mean, Drew wasn't very good last year.
Right.
But I think his grade was low 70s, which is what we've seen from Taysom Hill.
Which was like the good version of Trevor Siemian. We're right. Like, hey, look, Trevor Simeon's actually playing really well right now. That was like bad Breeze.
Right. So let's preview with Taysom Hill. Let's preview with Trevor Siemian, and then we'll just cut it based off whatever. So Trevor Simeon's the starting quarterback. What are we expecting here? He's kind of come back down to earth in recent weeks here.
Pain. Yeah, I mean, we saw on Thanksgiving that the Trevor Siemian gravy train probably ran out of wheels at this point, and like this is who we're dealing with.
Now that you quoted Mr. T, Clubber Lang here,
the great Clubber Lang,
your big idea for us to have a little side podcast someday and kind of go back and review 80s movies and all that stuff.
Which turns out basically the Bill Simmons already does.
Oh, he already
does. Rewatchables.
Oh.
Now, we could do it with other things. It doesn't have to be movies, but you know, we could expand it to a different. Also, they're like, the people that he has on that podcast are very, what's the polite way of saying this? They are academic in terms of like movie structure. You know what I mean? Like they're commenting
on that's not what we're worried about.
Form and lighting and cinematography. Whereas I'm like, they unfurled a giant Ivan Drago poster in front of like 100 people that were sitting in a seat. And that feels like a problem. Like, I think it's a lot less, you know.
You're going to pick apart the logic here.
Yeah.
The logic of,
and the idiot stuff, not the like actual filmmaking.
So, again, I'm not trying to get this off the rails because we're up against it. We're up against it. We got a time limit on Wednesdays.
Okay.
Not really. We're open-ended.
What was the point you were making?
You said you saw the director's cut of Rocky IV last night.
I did.
Should that be its own? Would anybody listen to to an episode of Steve and Sam breaking down the Rocky IV? Director's cut, the real Rocky IV, whatever. You know?
Yeah.
It's a historical movie.
Well, the original is. The director's cut is a waste of somebody's, like a year of somebody's life.
Oh, no. Did the director's cut, would that have also ended the
Cold War? And remember,
the
director is Sly, right? So at some point, bored out of his gourd, Sly just decided to go back and remake Rocky IV in a studio somewhere.
Bill Simmons does a really good job of connecting, you know, current events, old events, and all that stuff, in making, you know, making it entertaining and all that stuff. He may have been the one that said originally that Rocky was the one who ended the Cold War. With the Soviets. I think that was initially him. You know, got the ball rolling back in 1985. By 1989, the wall fell and the whole thing, you know, the whole thing crumbled.
That was the first domino?
Absolutely was. Okay. When Rocky goes over there. I mean, Christmas night in Moscow.
The whole Politburo stood up and applauded him.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean
it's no coincidence that within 4 years, USSR was no longer.
SSRR.
Yeah. Or within 6 years, whatever the exact time was.
Not to spoiler it or anything, but if you really liked the original, I wouldn't recommend watching the director's cut.
Man.
40 minutes of new footage, apparently, but it's the same length. So they stripped out 40 minutes of the original movie, and the original movie was okay. So why just leave it alone. Go find something else to meddle with.
Well, that's sad.
Find
sad
a crappy movie that nobody cares about. Fix that one.
Just trying to figure out if people would be entertained by us going back and picking apart Arnold movies and all that stuff.
Arnie movies. Somebody liked the Commando reference from the other day.
Yeah. I mean, some of his one-liners are just absolutely incredible.
Particularly in Commando. I mean, that movie's, that's some high-level stuff right there.
Anyway, just throwing that out there. No more spoilers on the director's cut with Rocky IV other than sounds a little disappointing.
They did keep in the No Easy Way Out montage, though.
Yeah, that's good.
If that hadn't have showed up, I'd have switched it off right there.
No, it's iconic, man. It is iconic. And I wonder if Paulie got to see the Rose Bowl game. He was real worried about seeing the Rose Bowl when he was out in Moscow in the snow. Anyway, back to the Saints. I don't know how we got off on that, but it's my fault, off on that tangent. Saints, quarterback. What would you expect from Taysom Hill at quarterback? What did we see from Taysom Hill last year when he was the starter?
I think you see a quarterback that is capable of taking short underneath passes that are fairly well schemed up with, you know, the threat of his rush, the threat he brings on the ground, RPOs, those kinds of things, and is critically unable to hit a deep ball. Now, I don't think it's because he doesn't have an arm. Like, Taysom Hill can throw the ball a requisite amount of distance to hit the deep ball, but he puts the ball in the air about 2 seconds after it needs to be, so it doesn't matter how strong his arm is. Like, unless it's Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes, which it isn't, he's going to be underthrowing those deep balls, and that's a problem. Particularly when you have receivers that are not amazing like the Saints. So I think he's the best option that the Saints have right now. He gives you the best combination of being able to create an offense that's awkward enough to defend and different enough that most defenses are not used to dealing with it. And he is a really good runner. Like, he's got genuine skills with the ball in his hands, particularly when, like last year, he didn't have the best grade in the world in terms of running because he kept fumbling the damn ball. Like, if you can figure that out and just wrap it up and not lose control of it, that moves him on a huge amount. If he can figure out how to put the ball in the air early enough when he's throwing deep, massive like ability. But you know, I wouldn't have high expectations, but I think it's at least, if you're going to have a substandard, relatively crappy quarterback, at least make one that's difficult and a pain in the ass to defend. Nobody is concerned about Trevor Siemian, which is the biggest problem right now. He might be able to play slightly better than Taysom Hill, but not in a way that actually concerns a defense or causes them any kind of sleepless nights over the week planning for it. Taysom Hill, whatever you think about how good he is at least a pain in the ass to game plan for. And that, I think there's merit to that.
Yeah, I mean, he's good in the design running game. He's good, you know, you can run QB power and counter and all that stuff. You also have injuries up front, too, which also hurts, right? Having Ryan Ramczyk and Teron Armstead, the best tackle tandem in the NFL, they're both banged up. We'll see if they can go. But that also hurts as well, because this, if it was Taysom and you have this pretty good run-blocking offensive line, you build the scheme around him and all that stuff. You mentioned all the fumbles and everything, and I think this has shown up with Lamar Jackson through the years as well. Dynamic runner. But there are a lot of fumbles that show up. Not necessarily all even Lamar's fault, but you get mesh point fumbles. You get some that are Lamar's fault. That is where maybe EPA would be a good proxy for how much do you want to have a run-first system with the quarterback? Because if you know the fumbles will, you know, essentially give you a good idea of just how effective the run game is as a whole. But anyway, I think what happens with those guys, with a Taysom, he doesn't have to be a precision passer. Like Trevor Siemian has to be a precision passer to move the ball.
Right.
Whereas Taysom Hill can affect the game on the ground, create more open throws, like you said, because it's not just it's play action where you also have to account for the quarterback, right? So you have to account for two people on play action, a running back and a quarterback, not just the running back when it's Trevor Siemian. So I think it opens up what the Saints' offensive potential is. Not that they can't have ugly games with Taysom, but the high end, it's a higher end offense, I think, and really higher floor just because of the run game.
That's the component. Thing. I think the floor is higher, the ceiling is higher, and the baseline is probably about the same. But you have a wider range of outcomes. The range of outcomes is about the same. But I think in every step of the way, the band is tighter, like with Trevor Siemian at quarterback. Like you're going to get this fairly middle of the road, average to below average performance from him, and there's not much scope for anything else happening. With Taysom Hill, you shouldn't be terrible because he can bring a pretty high baseline with that run threat. He can complete the short passes. There's the potential that you have something way better if he connects and all those things that he misses on, doesn't fumble the ball. And then it's just a case of what is your average performance going to be like? And again, like the average, like what is the benefit of Trevor Siemian? And the one argument is, well, if you combine Trevor Siemian and Taysom Hill, you have something greater. But they haven't even been using Taysom Hill like that since he's come back from injury. So you're not getting the benefit of that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if that's really the case because you still have Trevor Siemian under center for a much, you know, most of the game. It's still him under center.
Yeah.
And it's not like every time Taysom Hill is playing H-back or tight end or running back or whatever that it's a productive play for the offense. On the other side, we got Dak Prescott with a career-high 85.9 PFF grade. His rushing grade is low in part, again, because of his fumbles. He's had a bunch of turnover-worthy plays when carrying the ball this year, but continues to progress as a passer. Started off slow in the Thanksgiving game against the Raiders, started to get it going down the stretch, hitting some deep balls to Michael Gallup, seam route to Dalton Schultz. Dak, though, has been one of the better quarterbacks in the league this year. So I like Dallas because of that, especially if Amari Cooper comes back, even if it is in a limited sample. I think the Saints, they just have at home, dome and all that stuff. They just got wrecked there, though, by the Bills, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to overrate that home field advantage and all that. I think Dallas is just a better overall team, and things are starting to crumble in New Orleans because they're just outmanned from the quarterback position out.
They are. Their offensive line has got some problems as well. I do think, though, that Dallas, like, as much as they kind of got going towards the end, but the first three quarters, really, of that game, Dak was not playing particularly well.
I know.
And he fell off, and I think there are some issues there with Dallas that they haven't necessarily, they're not as hot as they were earlier in the season. And I think the Saints could cause them some problems. So I'm going to lean the Saints to cover this.
So you get the Saints covering. It's 4.5 at the moment here, Wednesday afternoon, heading into Thursday Night Football. I'll take the Cowboys to cover. So throw that on the sheet. I'll take the Cowboys. They've got four losses. If they do ever want to get in, it's going to be tough to get the number one seed at this point, but These games matter for the Cowboys, not only for that, but just, as you said, for the division, the football
Washington's
team.
Washington's coming.
Well, football team is on their heels, and we thought the Eagles were too before they
Lost to the Giants. That's the thing about this division, right, is that as much as you're sort of writing it down, penciling in these games of they'll win these two, like you're going to have games like that where randomly the Giants show up and beat a team they're not supposed to and just wreck the whole thing for everybody.
All right. Anything else to cover?
No.
Today?
We out.
All right. Great Wednesday show. Appreciate everybody tuning in, either live on YouTube or in podcast land. Again, we'll be back on Thursday previewing all of the Week 13 NFL action. Don't forget, PFF.com, 40% off, use Cyber40. And thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.